We're going to have a question here in just a minute. Our experience at home is a little bit different. My son, who's now 11, I think from the time he was in the womb, was asking, you know, things like where was God in the Holocaust and stuff like that. So he's in, as he says, he's into Jewish tragedy. To me, you know, and honest to goodness, this is an existential thing every single day. I'm thinking about, I realize this part of my brain, whatever I'm doing, whether I'm at work or driving, is thinking, how am I going to answer Akiva tonight? Because I know he's going to say something. And part of what I've come to about this is that there's really no escape, and one shouldn't want to. In other words, children are who they are, and they're beautiful in their own way. And I am doing my mightiest, and my wife is going beyond the mightiest, to model exactly what we'd want our kids to be, and to be that model as opposed to talking it, but being it. But at the end of the day, God made people with freedom. And my children exercise their freedom. They're very good at that mitzvah. They exercise their freedom in a variety of beautiful ways. And so there's a certain level where you're just going to let things be as they are. And I think very crucially that here's where faith really comes in. Not just faith in God, but faith in people. Faith in the faith in the process of what it means to raise children and to believe that somewhere, some down the line, something that you've been talking about or thinking about or modeling will creep its seed into things. And that's a very insecure feeling, because often we want things to be really smooth, and it doesn't always work that way. I guess one thing I've seen from teaching high school students for many years is that kids that you never would have banked on when they were 16 are incredible diamonds when they're 25. You don't know it, you can't see it, but you do your thing, and you hope that your thing hits, and I think it's really no different with one's family. So that ends our formal part. I'd like you to give these three a big hand. Rabbi Kelman is going to make a couple of announcements, and then we're going to throw things open to the floor, and he's actually going to talk about that process.
Thank you very much. I must say this was a fascinating evening, and really just a lot of the insight, and you know, I guess a little bit of a critique on myself. I'm good friends with, you know, three of the four people on the panel, and the fourth one I just met a couple hours ago. So, and I really learned a lot about the three of them that I didn't really know. And perhaps that's a criticism of, quote-unquote, I guess I'm from the FFB community. And, you know, we haven't really talked about these issues. We talk about many issues, but we haven't talked about this. And I just think it's such a wonderful forum and really a great opportunity. I hope we can actually do it again. I think there's a lot. We're only scratching the surface. Between faculty, we do not know. Good. Just before, what we're going to do, and I think what we'll do is we'll take about 25 minutes of questions, just so you can kind of pace yourself. It's now about 7 minutes onto 10. Let's say we go till between 10:15 and 10:20. We'll end the formal part, and then maybe a round if there are questions. What I think the best way to do it is, if you have a question, come up and speak in the microphone. We'll take 3-4 questions at a time, and then I think you can address all of them if that's acceptable to our... And then I have an announcement while you're thinking.
So just two rules. Number one, when you're asking a question, if it's for a specific person, please preface by saying, I'm addressing this question to so-and-so. And in the interest of time, no speeches. Respectfully, we would ask just questions. Thank you.
Just a couple of announcements. I figure it's easier if I do it now in terms of tomorrow's program. First of all, we hope you'll all be here. Those who are not registered yet for tomorrow, you can register now. We'll count the payment of tonight towards the program on tomorrow. If you want to buy a Kim Pass, we'll count it all towards that. If you are registered, please bring your lunch ticket and your name tag with you. It'll just smooth over the process of registration. If you can't come all day tomorrow and you're only interested in one session, we will have a discount, $18 for one session. If that's, I urge everybody, they should come, really. It's a tremendous day. And there's a lot of great things, but our keynote session's at 11:15. That is the one point of the day where everybody will be in one place. The rest of the day we are split up. Please fill out the evaluation forms for tonight and tomorrow. Just, you know, we're always interested in feedback, and I think with that, that's all the announcements I'm going to make. We hope we'll see you all tomorrow and throughout the year, and we're interested in your feedback. So please, if you have any questions, as Elliot said, keep it short, and we'll go ahead.
I just want to say that Dr. Aiken is going to be, she's brought a number of her books with her and would be very interested. And her tape, so if people are interested in talking to her, buying a tape, buying a book, that will happen outside directly after question.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Firstly, I'd like to echo the remarks how fascinating this evening has been. My question is this. Intuitively, one would expect a ballet teshuva to be most comfortable in the modern Orthodox community because of their background, and yet I gather from at least you that this is not so. Would you like to comment on this, why it should be so? Thank you.
Next question. In the course of your discussions, I heard you use the phrase inconsistent or inconsistency several times. That only makes sense if you know what your reference is. Perhaps you could elaborate what you mean when you say inconsistent.
This is a question basically for all the panelists, but we talked a bit about a wish list for the mainstream community. I think it's important and valid for the Balei Tshuva themselves to be self-critical and to talk a little bit about their own rejection of conservative or reform and their, I guess, you know, at some points, creation of divisiveness in the Jewish community, because in their fervor to some, in some fervor to renew their religion, there's a lot of criticism of their own past, and I think that's particularly troubling and divisive. So I wanted you to comment on that.
I know this is kind of an open-ended question, and it might be beyond the scope of this forum, but some of you are in the academic community. And I just want to know if there are any specific challenges that you faced, Dr. Lowy, Dr. Aiken, in confronting the questions about academics and and that kind of community with becoming an Orthodox Jew.
Last question.
You've all worked so hard in your own personal development in becoming Balei Tshuva. I was just wondering, specifically Elliot, because of some of the things you have said in terms of the freedom of each individual, how you think you could handle a possibility of those children that you are rearing to the best of your ability to be observant Jews, how would you handle it if they turned about and were not? Thank you.
I'm going to take the questions in order, and I'm just going to address the first one and hand over the mic for the rest. If somebody wants to answer the one that was addressed to me, you can do that too. In a sense, why are there not a lot of Balei Tshuva in the modern Orthodox community? And actually, I've thought about that. I think it's multifaceted. Partly that has to do with the nature of being a Baal Tshuva, and partly, frankly, it has to do with the nature of current modern Orthodoxy. Michael used a wonderful analogy, a wonderful metaphor, that there's a lot of issues that go through a Baal Tshuva's mind, a lot of energy, and it's like a spring, and you get out of the box. And when you get out of the box with that kind of passion and fervor, you're looking for something that matches your passion and fervor, something that matches your quest. Now, in my own case, interestingly, I started out much more to the right, and in a way, because these labels are almost meaningless to me, I guess you could classify me as somewhere in the middle now, but it's sort of irrelevant because I see the sort of benefits and complexities of all these communities. But for many of us, modern Orthodoxy, and Eric alluded to it slightly, currently did not present a model of religious passion, a model of halachic seriousness, a model of anything other than sort of religion as kind of like what we do, my work. You know, we keep Shabbos, we keep kosher, but the kinds of things you're looking for, because once you're sprung out of that box, you're really moving. And you're really looking for people to sort of incorporate and go with that kind of passion. I think that's something that can become problematic afterwards, because you're also looking for a way to kind of temper that fervor in a mature way where you can begin to not see the world in binary black-white terms, but in more multi-layered terms. And that's why, in a way, my own case, I began to move off of certain kinds of Haredi formulations that I incorporated when I first became from. But that community still remains to me a model of passion. I'll just give a really personal example because it was so clear to me. I recently underwent surgery, and when my family went to visit me downtown at Mount Sinai Hospital, there was an apartment that was set up by Bikur Cholim, right, which was for people to stay over Shabbos so that they could walk the couple of blocks. And I have to say, that is something from the Haredi world. And there are many such examples. In other words, these are people who don't just talk the talk. They believe that God is watching, and they believe that their mitzvot are real. And even if personality-wise, that isn't a complete fit for me, because there's certain ways that I grew up to think. Still on? No? See what happened when
God
I said, that it's not a fit for me, and the mic turned off. Even though it's not a perfect fit for me, I think it would just be crass, and I think it would be intellectually dishonest to not recognize those kinds of passions. When I looked around at modern Orthodoxy, naming no names in Toronto, I saw a really flaccid community. I saw a community that wasn't committed to Torah study as a kind of bones and guts existential endeavor. I saw a community that was very comfortable in cutting corners halachically in terms of what we call real sacrifice. And so I don't think it's an accident, actually. And the biggest reason is because it wasn't a priority of that community to be Makarov people. They don't see it as a mission. They were very sort of, it's odd when you think about Haredi insularity, that in many ways the modern Orthodox world is even more insular, because they see no reason to go out and do these kinds of things. And as Eric said, the Shabbat invitations were not coming from sort of traditional modern Orthodox people. I don't mean to tar with one brush and to generalize. It's obvious that there are subtleties here, that there are, one can't generalize. But I would stand behind the comments I made.
I think part of what I'm hearing tonight is maybe Toronto-centric. Because it's actually, if you look at the landscape of North American Jewry, it might be one of the few large North American Jewish communities that has actually a relatively small modern Orthodox community, whereas the norm tends to be, I guess, in Toronto, more to the right. And I think part of the reason I'm hearing people speak maybe in terms that are not familiar to myself is that my early experiences Jewishly were in New York, in Manhattan, in Bergen County, New Jersey, places like Teaneck, where it's actually the exact opposite, where the Haredi community wasn't really strong in Manhattan, and I was really exposed to, I think, the best and the strongest of the modern Orthodox world, people like Shlomo Riskin, who had a tremendous impact on myself. Notwithstanding, I have to say that, to answer the question, I really appreciate the reasons and the dynamics why, in all circumstances, there may be a pull to the right, and why people don't necessarily end up firmly planted in the modern Orthodox world. I remember when I first met my wife, I was exposed to someone whose initial Jewish experiences were not in New Jersey, but in Jerusalem. And here I'm meeting someone whose immersion in Judaism was much more to the right than mine. And I remember on one of our first dates, she said something very cute. She said, "Well, Michael, you were dipped in vanilla, and I was dipped in chocolate." And I think that what happens for all of us, I think Elliot mentioned this, I think it's true. All of us, whether we are Bali Tshuva or people that are thoroughbred from birth, congenital Jews, we're all in process. All of us are in process. The truth is, all Jews are Bali Tshuva because we come, our energy is from Abraham, who was a Bal Tshuva. And we can't get it out, we can't shake that part of who we are. All of us are people in the process and going through this amazing journey of life, and we're all struggling with our Jewishness, sometimes in different ways. I think what happens with many people that I see in the Bal Tshuva world is that there's a concern for, A, the word was mentioned, authenticity, which I think is a very delicate and problematic word, but more importantly, a sense of stability and a sense that I'm moving in a direction that has some hope for the future, maybe. And I suspect that many people that are struggling with their place in Judaism have an intuitive sense that the more Haredi world is here and they're here to stay. And there's a certain comfort knowing that this is a path that has a secure, it's like investing in a non-risky investment. Whereas I suspect that the model of the Bal Tshuva in the modern Orthodox world is almost like I envision being on a tightrope. And I suspect that modern Orthodoxy is a path in life that might allow us to even go higher because it is more diverse, it is more open, there is more possibility, and yet it's a riskier venture. When you're up on that tightrope, you can very easily fall off. And I suspect that the Bal Tshuva, who is looking for a little bit less of a tenuous kind of a life, with more security, might be drawn toward a world that seems less gray and more black.
The second question was the reference point for consistency, and since I think it was Eric who kept using that word, I'm going to pass it over to you.
I just wanted to say that much of what I think we were asked to speak about was highly retrospective, and so I wouldn't want to confuse the person who asked the first question and have them believe that I really feel that I'm firmly ensconced in the Haredi world today. In fact, it's a term which I really didn't use until recently, and now I find that I use it quite often because I'm quite aware of the both, in a way, triumph and also triumphalism of the Haredi world, and I do find it disturbing in many ways. Yes, it's good when your kids come home more firm than you, and you expect that, but to a point. I want my children also to perhaps at least be able to experience the beauty of Sibelius' Second Symphony, which I remember Elliot and I once hearing. TSO played it terribly, but okay. And maybe even to experience the challenges that I experienced when I read Spinoza's Tractatus. I'm not sure about that. Depends on the kid. That's a delicate issue. I'm not really that closely tied to the Haredi world, despite what I have to say. In terms of consistency, let me give you a simple example. My parents go to a minyan, probably heard of Rabbi Elise Goldstein. Last year, I believe Rosh Hashanah was on Shabbat. As you know, Halakha says that one doesn't blow shofar on Rosh Hashanah. The machloket actually be Rishalmi and the Bavli, but why you do that without going to the lachic details of the Bavli is because you might carry Hashem Yitzvana Dalet Amoba Rishut Abim. You might come to carry it on Shabbat. And Hotza Az Milacha, and Shabbat is a serious business. So at least Goldstein's minyan, they don't blow shofar when Rosh Hashanah coincides with Shabbat. Now, if you asked anyone in that minyan about Hotza'ah, they would not have a clue what you're talking about. And even if they informed them about what you were talking about, these are people who, whatever reason they do it, carry every single Shabbat of the year without thinking twice about it. And even if you told them about it, would continue to carry. To me, that was just a non-starter in terms of a consistent vision of Jewish living. And if you multiply that type of inconsistency 1,000 times, I just couldn't make sense. Not to mention people not coming to religious school to Hoy Blossom because the ski season has started, and so on and so forth. Those were the sort of things that were very hard for me to reconcile.
Well, that's actually a great segue to the third question. What about Bal Tshuva rejection of conservative and reform movement? I'm going to have to think about that one. I don't have an immediate answer. I don't know if anybody here does.
I'll say a slightly different response. Fairly recently, I was asked to address a girls' seminary in Jerusalem about the whole topic of Bal Tshuva and the issues that face Bali Tshuva. And one of the things that I mentioned to the young women is that very often when we get our religious fervor, we we go back to our parents and we basically say, whatever you are, whatever you do, it's not enough, it's not good, you're not authentic, you're not whatever. And they rightfully feel very rejected. And I think that there's a way that we can show a great deal of sensitivity even if we don't adopt our parents' way of life or a certain sect of Judaism's way of living without being so incredibly offensive. As I mentioned in my own journey, I would say that on a scale of 1 to 10 of being offensive, my brother and I were pretty close to 10. And unfortunately for us, back in the early 70s, we had no models of how to become Balei Tshuva. This was a wholly new phenomenon. This didn't really exist before. And nobody came and said to us, by the way, when you leave this week of religious intensity and you go back to your parents, you don't throw their dishes away, you don't tell them their Judaism's no good. You know, we were teenagers. We did what teenagers do best, and that's to be pontificating and to be righteous and to know that we're totally right and to tell everybody else they're wrong. And so I think that part of the response to this question is that when people become exposed to more observant Judaism, to understand that the commandment to respect your parents and to practice the Ahavta L'Reicha Kamocha doesn't mean you only do it with Jews that you think are just like you. And to equip people with responses when you do go home and you'd like to keep kosher and your parents think it's, you know, thrown away from the Middle Ages, how do you respond to people like that in a sensitive and appropriate way? So one of the things that I tell people, if they ask me, which most people don't, it's one of the nice things about being a therapist, you can tell people lots of things they don't want to hear, is I express to people that, you know, when you go home to your parents love you, they feel they've invested a great deal in your life, and you say to them, you know, I really appreciate that you've given me all the tools that I have to think about my life and to appreciate what it means to be a Jew, and I'm going to be taking a slightly different path than you have. It doesn't mean I don't love you. It doesn't mean I don't want to have a relationship with you. I will always love you. You'll always be my parents. And I hope you'll appreciate that we can be different and still be part of one family. And I think when it comes to relating to either Reform or Conservative Jews or synagogues in which people were raised in Reform or Conservative values, that people can still express the fact, you know, I appreciate that I came here and I found something very authentic about Judaism, and I'm going to be taking a slightly different path because of the tools that you gave me.
I was also that type of teenager. And I think it's even if you're not a teenager, there's a certain extremism which is understandable, if perhaps regrettable, which makes you highly rejectionist perhaps at the beginning, perhaps. But I would say that over time I've come to appreciate, you know, what different movements in Judaism can offer, even if they're not my movements. And I do try to impart that to my children. My cousin is not the Chazan, but the Chazanit at the Temple Har Zion. And Temple Har Zion is, I think, the one temple, at least north of Steeles, that does with certain churches a program called Out of the Cold. They take in hundreds of homeless people one night a week as part of a rotation. I must say that I don't think in a long time my place of worship would even think to do that, let alone execute that thought. And that's something I want my children to know and admire and aspire to. And I want them to understand that we fall short in this area. We do not live up to that high standard that they set. And this is a mitzvah area too, as important as kashrut and all the others. In terms of my parents, I have no problem telling my children, and we often do tell children, my parents are stellar exemplars of so many different types of mitzvot. I mean, my mother is a tzedekit in terms of shiva calls, in terms of visiting sick people, going to bakeries, calling people who are shut in, and so on and so forth. We tell them over and over again. They do many, many mitzvot. My father is a dedicated physician, and all the sorts of things he does beyond the call of duty for his patients. They do many, many mitzvot. Bein Adam L'Chaveiro, more than Bein Adam L'Makom, to use that traditional designation. But Im Kol Zeh, we just had in this week's Parsha, Lo Nechtam El Al HaGezel, right? The bottom line was that the Kodesh Baruch Hu could tolerate everything, that the Rashi source in the Gemara is even stronger. Hakol, everything would have been okay. But when people started stealing from each other, God said, forget it. We're going to have a flood. So on that score, my children, not that they're Reform, not that they're conservative, these labels which, you know, stereotype people and box people in. They're Jewish people doing worthy Jewish things. They do it often out of Jewish motives. My mother says, I'm making a shiva call. You know, it's not just something she got from some, you know, humanist handbook. It's something she was raised with and she implements. And so on that score too, I think I can tell my children there's a lot tomorrow. On the other hand, I do have to tell my children, and they already know, that there are certain parts where, you know, obviously we leave the train.
I'm going to answer this a little bit. I think it was a terrific question, I just want to tell you. And I relate to this question. And I'm going to answer now, not as, you know, Baal Teshuva, but as co-founder of Torah in Motion. You have to understand that the culture of rejection is universal. You're talking about, you know, Orthodox people rejecting conservative and Reform Jews, a phenomenon that doesn't impress me, because I'm a person who believes in disagreement, not, you know, annihilation, not negation. Unfortunately, in the Jewish world today, people are afraid of ideas. It's a culture of fear, basically. People don't want to get together and disagree anymore. They want to just say, you don't like think like me, I'm not going to talk to you. I'm not going to be seen with you. I'm not going to associate with you. How do I know this? Because of this work. I can tell you, not anecdotally, but factually, that there's enormous pressure in Toronto to shut us down. Why? Because we're being rejected by other Orthodox people who think of us as conservative and Reform Jews, whatever. Is this based on fact? Is it based on rationality? Is it based on anything? No, it's based on fear. The culture of rejection, basically, in the current Jewish community is, if you don't think like me, and I mean exactly like me, exactly inside of a narrow kind of circle, you are treif. That's true of Orthodox attitudes to conservative and Reform. That's true of ultra-Orthodox attitudes to other Orthodox Jews, and that's the bottom line. And it's true the reverse. Everybody bashes everybody else, and I'll just tell you, out of the cold, I'll tell you a story. I went to, at one time I was hoping to do the Out of the Cold program, and I went to Holy Blossom, and there was a presentation. And there was a presentation, in this case, it was to visit AIDS patients in the hospital. The rabbi got up, I won't say which rabbi it was and what year it was, the rabbi got up and said, you know, Orthodox Jews think homosexuality is an abomination. I was the only person there who was Orthodox. I was a little bit queasy, but, you know, I'm a fighter. So I raised my hand respectively, and I said, with all due respect, that's inaccurate. The Bible, and I cite a chapter and verse, lists homosexuality as an abomination. Now, you want to quarrel with that, you think that's disgusting, offensive, not modern, quarrel with the Bible. But don't lay that trip on Orthodox Jews. Was this listened to? No. Because 2 minutes later, the same kind of Orthodox bashing happened. And then, interestingly enough, the rabbi quoted, you know why we have to do this mitzvah? Because of v'ahavta l'reicha kamocha, love your neighbors yourself. Now, what's ironic about this is, of course, it's the same parak. It's the same chapter of the Bible. But so people do not want to deal with the complexity of religion. Because the truth is, the Bible is a heartbreakingly complex book. It's not simple. It's not just my ideology, my agenda, what I want it to be. It's very difficult stuff, because real religion is difficult stuff. Real learning is difficult. Real issues are difficult. So instead, people take the easy road and just bash anything that's not like them, from the right to the left, or the left to the right. We had a panel last year in last year's conference with Norman Lamb and Yaakov Yosef Reinman and Nathan Cardozo and Penny Dunner, and boy, it was hard to get those guys together, and I'm not sure I'd ever get it together again. And one of the things that came out is that I asked Rabbi Lamb, would you have a dialogue with a Jew for Jesus? And he said no. And Rabbi Reinman pointed out, we draw our lines, we all draw lines, we just draw them differently. You know, because Rabbi Reinman had said, I would not talk to a Reform rabbi. And the truth is that everybody's got a circle that they call Jewish legitimacy that they will not allow, and outside of that circle is people they don't think are legitimate for whatever reason. I'm not quarreling with people's individual choices, but the point is this is a universal phenomenon. Just to move along, the challenges of being from in an academic community, whoever wants to take that.
I was going to say, let Eric go first.
I think these cut a lot of different ways. It's really for a different panel, I think, that question. It's a very good question, certainly one that I relate to. I can say that sometimes it's hard to speak to different audiences different ways and have people credit the fact that it's appropriate to speak differently at York University, say, than it is when I speak in shul, which I often am asked to do. You know, picking up where Elliot left off a little bit, I also have come under pressure, in part because of the way that I teach. Because I wear a kippah and people make certain assumptions about what I say and how I'm going to say it. And the truth is, when I speak at the Bayit, I may say it X way or Y way, but when I speak at York, I might say something very different in a very different way, and I consider that appropriate. But it can be very hard to, you know, to divide your personality in a way that everyone will respect. Can also cause, you know, internal problems in terms of how consistent you're being when you speak to one group one way and another group the other way. Although I think, you know, we all do that. You don't speak to a 3-year-old the way you speak to a 10-year-old the way you speak to a 20-year-old. And so that's an activity that we all engage in. The flip side is that I think you can provide a model for students on campus. Most of my students are either non-Jewish or Jewish, but in some way, shape, or form, not Orthodox. And I think it can be a bit bracing for them to see that I get up there and I do indeed quote Spinoza, not to mention Hobbes, Rousseau, Locke, and a lot of other people. And in that sense, I think it breaks down stereotypes, potentially. Finally, given how difficult it can be to be a Jew on campus, leaving aside the intellectual issues, Israel bashing, and so on and so forth, I think there, you know, there can be a role for Orthodox academics who can unabashedly espouse both the religiosity and some of their, you know, Zionism in a way that gives students more backbone than they otherwise would have to deal with a sort of very rough and tumble atmosphere on campuses nowadays.
The hour's late. And I'm really of great admiration for you for hanging in for 2 hours. I'm sure all of us be happy to talk to you for a little bit afterwards. The last question was for me. What would I do if my kids became secular? I would love them. You know, because I don't consider my attachment to them conditional on their religious choices. I'm going to be honest. Of course, I would be greatly disappointed. But I'd be disappointed not because I have some cookie-cutter model that they have to be like me. It's not a narcissistic thing. I didn't choose religion out of some sort of subjectivity necessarily. I think this stuff is true. I believe that the Torah comes from Sinai. I don't always understand the process, and I think it's complicated. I think, as you know, Dr. Aiken spoke so eloquently, that God has a relationship with Jewish people. I've spent half my life teaching this stuff, and I don't teach what I don't believe in. So when I want this for my children, I don't want it for my children just because I want, you know, my son and daughter to be like Daddy. I want my son and daughter in a world that's very difficult to grow up in, and that has a lot of challenges and dangers, to adopt a way of life that I see as permanent, as meaningful, and as real, both in this world and the next. So that's what my wife and I try and get across as much as possible to my children, and in the end, they'll make their choices. Thanks very much for coming.
As we leave, really, I just want to give a special thank you to our wonderful panel once again for such a beautiful evening and for all of you. Have a good evening, Shavua Tov, and we hope to see you in the morning.